Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future.
The people's flag is deepest red, it's shrouded off the mass of dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its foes we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
You're about to hear the second half of a speech by Eduardo Suplicy, a member of the Brazilian Senate representing the Workers' Party. Senator Suplicy spoke on February 21, 2004, at the third annual Congress of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Movement on the recent passage of a basic income guarantee in Brazil. In the first half of this talk, Senator Suplicy explained how the basic income guarantee was passed in Brazil. In the second half, he talks more generally about the economics and ethics of the policy. To find out more about the campaign for a basic income guarantee in your country, visit the website of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Movement at widerquist.com/usbig/. That's widerquist.com/usbig/.
I have been talking about this all over Brazil and mentioning all the things that I have listened this morning and this afternoon. You know already all the arguments why a universal basic income, an unconditional basic income, is good. But how come? Even to Pelé, to Ronaldinho, to, say, people like, well, Antônio Hermílio de Moraes, that would be someone like Bill Gates here. Yes, but of course, they will contribute proportionately more for themselves and for everybody to receive it. And then, because of that, we will simplify all the bureaucracy in having to know how much each one is earning in the formal or in the informal market. We will eliminate the stigma. And from the point of view of dignity and freedom of the person, anyone will feel much better knowing beforehand that in the next 12 months and from then on, year after year, each one will know that he or her will receive a modest but an income that with time will be sufficient to provide for his or her basic needs, for himself, herself, and for each person in the family. And I have been arguing that this is a proposition that is very consistent with the purpose of having the Brazilian economy organized in a more rational way and also is compatible with the competitiveness of the economy. And so with respect to the objective of having more job opportunities to everyone, I have been arguing that the basic income is very consistent with that purpose. And I have argued always, when speaking to entrepreneurs and to labor unionists and the workers in general, that we should be aware that in the United States, in England, and in the United Kingdom and in Europe, they have income transfer programs, that we should be aware of that, that if we don't also have one, they are in a better competitive position than ours. With the ITC, the U.S. is more competitive than we are without having any income transfer program of that kind, of a negative income tax form or an even better one that is the basic income form. And I can go more and more into this discussion. While I was, half of you here were in our, in one of the tables here where there was the discussion between the objective of having job creation and the guarantee of income. But when you were arguing that perhaps if you had the choice between the Norwegian system and the Alaskan system, having both having positive aspects in both situations. Well, let me tell you that when you have argued in favor of the Norwegian system, you have not considered, Philip, all the advantages of the Alaskan system that we will listen now with Jay Hammond's talk. But let me ask you, when you had the idea as the mayor of Bristol Bay,
yeah,
had you already read Agrarian Justice by Thomas Paine? And when you proposed the Alaska Permanent Fund idea, had you read Thomas Paine, Agrarian Justice?
No, not that. I'd read a little bit of Thomas Paine, but
yes.
not that.
And have you read until today Agrarian Justice by Thomas Paine?
No.
Let me tell then, I went to visit Alaska and the Alaska Permanent Fund office, and I went to visit the Alaskan governor, who is, I think that he's still, Tom Knowles. Is he?
Tony Knowles, he's out now.
Out now. Well, so I went to see him, and I complimented him for having the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend system, and I asked him, do you know that you are applying here the ideas of one of the main ideologues of the French, of the American and French Revolution? And I said, who? Well, Thomas Paine. Well, I didn't know. Well, it's here. And he thanked me. But so, would you like me to tell how you have had the same idea as Thomas Paine?
Would you like me to tell?
Yes. No, if you know already that your idea is very similar to that of Thomas Paine.
I accept that. I didn't know that. No.
Well,
Thomas didn't get it from me. I suspect that would be.
Well, you know about Thomas Paine's life much better than I know. But let me refresh your memory. Thomas Paine was born in 1734 in Thetford in England. And he later on became friend of Benjamin Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin persuaded him to live in America before the independence. And so he came. And he was a tax collector and a very observer of costumes and values. And he started to write about what he was seeing in America. And so he wrote many pieces, among them Common Sense, that was published in and distributed anonymously in the streets of Philadelphia and also in the 13 colonies. 150,000 copies of Common Sense. That was a tremendous edition for that time, no? And what he said in that Common Sense? Well, it is against common sense that an island dominates a continent, and things like that. Well, 6 months later, the Americans got their independence on the 4th of July. And George Washington wrote to a friend saying that no other text had such an impact on the minds of the people to fight for the independence as Common Sense by Thomas Paine. But he became very persecuted because of his very subversive ideas. So he didn't feel so well and went back to England. But in England, they started to burn his books. How come this man responsible for losing our main colony? So he went to France to fight for liberty, equality, and fraternity, and engaged so much in the French Revolution of 1789 that although being a foreigner, the French elected him to be a constituent. And in 1795, he wrote Agrarian Justice. What he says there, that poverty is something related to civilization and the institution of private property. Because in America, he had observed that among the Indians, since property was common to everyone, to all, there wasn't so much destitution as he saw in the villages and cities of Europe of that time, 200 years ago. So, but he said, well, it is of common sense that somebody that cultivates the land and makes a benefit to the land, that he could receive the income from his work and his property. But, and then he explains, my plan is the following. Everybody that cultivates the land and make a benefit to the land should separate a part of it to a fund that will pertain to everyone. And from this fund, once it accumulates, we will pay to everyone living in that country. And he says, this is a proposal for all nations. 15 pounds when the person completes 21 years of age, and 10 pounds when the person completes 50 years of age, and from then on, every year, and this would be around 1,500 pounds, and 1,000 pounds today, and each person will receive that, not as a charity, not as a donation, but as a citizen's right. The right for the person to be part of the wealth of the nation. Everybody should have the right to share. So, perhaps you don't know, I will just introduce now to what I... If I'm wrong, if I will tell now your history. In the way I tell my students, I have made, as I told you, perhaps, well, I don't know if 200, 300 lectures telling this story about that I've learned from you. So I will learn in a few minutes from yourself. But let me tell how I tell your story for to know, and then you correct me, okay? If I...
Well, I did not read the other book by Thomas Paine, but I did read Common Sense.
I see.
A lot of folks would say I didn't absorb very much of it.
I see. Well, then I tell my students, the workers, and in the Senate. Well, and President Lula told Philippe Vampires and everybody in the ceremony that I would like to compliment you, Senator Suplicy, for your persistency, because here is one example that when somebody really believes in something, you may fight for it and you will attain this goal. But, well, I really, today, I am more and more convinced of this idea. And I ask my audiences about the following thing. Now I want to tell you, how are we going to prove that this is a good idea? You have all studied mathematics, don't you? And when you finish the theorems of algebra, geometry, and trigonometry, and arithmetic, you say at the end, well, in Portuguese we say, CQD, how, como queríamos demonstrar. In English you use the Latin QED, that means
Quad erant demonstrate. Which was to be.
Yes. So, how we wanted to demonstrate, no? So let us. So I explain to my students, to my audience. Well, let us think of how is income distributed in Brazil. Well, if we are so happy to be for 5 times champions of the world in soccer. Unfortunately, we cannot be happy for being today the 6th most unequal economy in the world. And if we take the size of our pie and see how it is distributed, in Brazil our pie, let's say 1 trillion 500 billion reais last year is distributed, and it has been distributed in such a way that the 1% richest receive 13.5% of national income, whereas the 50% poorest also receive the same 13.5% of the national pie. Can we do something to change this? Suppose we were to separate 5% of the pie and distribute equally to all 170 million inhabitants of Brazil every year for the next few decades. What would happen? Is there an example in the world to show what would happen? Yes, it is in Alaska. What has happened in Alaska? In the early 60s, the mayor of a small fisherman village, as we do have many in Brazil, as in South Africa, as in Timor-Leste, as in the States, He observed that a huge amount of wealth was coming out from that place, but many people were still poor. So the mayor said, let us institute a 3% tax on the value of fish. And he had much trouble in persuading the people to accept that. He said, well, I will even diminish the property tax. But finally, after 5 years of trying to persuade the people, he finally got the acceptance of all, and including the property tax and also the tax on fish. And he was so successful that 10 years later, he became the governor of the state of Alaska. In 1976, there were 300,000 inhabitants. And Alaska had recently discovered a huge amount of oil. For example, in 1969, they had sold leasing rights to explore the oil of the Bay of the Purgeau Bay by $900 million in 1969. So, in 1976, he told his people, we should think not only of our present generation, but also on the future generation, because oil, as other natural resources, are non-renewable. So, let us separate 50% of the royalties coming out from the exploitation of natural resources to a fund that will pertain to all. And he wanted this proposal not only to be approved as a constitutional amendment by the state assembly, but also by the people. That's why he proposed the referendum, and 2-1, he won. And for 4 years, they discussed how would the fund be managed. And they invited several economists, some Nobel Prize winners, Kenneth Arrow, Milton Friedman also had a conversation with the Alaskan authorities and so on. And some people said, let us have a development bank, as we do have in Brazil. But others said, be careful. This will be a way to... I have read the proceedings of the discussions. This will be a way of providing subsidized funds to entrepreneurs who have already a huge amount of wealth. They will create firms, perhaps jobs, but this will make income and wealth very concentrated. So let us do it equal for all. And so they did. And since 1980, those funds were applied and well, U.S. stocks and also bonds, U.S. bonds, but also U.S. Stocks of Alaskan companies contributing to diversified economy, stocks of U.S. companies, stocks of international companies, including in 1995, there were stocks of 6 Brazilian companies. So we contribute for you to have the Alaska Permanent Fund System.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And real estate investments. And the net wealth of the Alaska Permanent System evolved from $1 billion in 1980 to $25 billion last year. $28 billion right now. So, and every citizen living in Alaska, no matter origin, age, sex, color, civil or socioeconomic condition, as long as writes in one application form of just one page, I am Eduardo, I live in this address, work in this address, and a few questions more. Two persons say this is the truth that knows the person. Very simple. If the person and the person also fulfill for the children, for their children, up to 18 years of age, as long as this is the only requirement to live there for a year or more, then on the first week of October, this person has received first 300, then 400, 500, and so on. Last year, $1,507. In a family of four, $4,428 as the right to participate in the wealth of the nation, as Thomas Paine had written in 1795. And J. Hammond talked with Thomas Paine in the sky, in heaven, and he proposed the same thing in Bristol Bay, and this is the best demonstration that it really works. How come? Now, Philip, the mathematical demonstration. Is it good or not? what has been the result that you didn't tell the people there, but now I may tell you, and we will listen to him. But you know Scott Goldsmith's paper presented in 1979 in the year 2002 in Geneva. What happened with Alaska with respect to the 50 American states? It has become the most equal, I'm just finishing, the most equal of the 50 American states. During the 90s, for example, that the American economy did relatively well, especially during Clinton's years. Well, the 20% richest families from 1989 to 1999 had an increase in their average income of 26%, whereas the average income of the 20% poorest families also increased, but by 12%. So the richest had an increase in their income more than twice the income of the poorest. And in Alaska, the richest, the 20% richest families also increased by 7%. So they had a progress. But the average income of the 20% poorest had an increase in their average income of 28%, four times more. Please, quad.
QED.
QED. How we wanted to demonstrate it, okay? Congratulations.
You've just heard the second half of a speech by Eduardo Suplicy, a member of the Brazilian Senate representing the Workers' Party. Senator Suplicy spoke on February 21, 2004, at the third annual Congress of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Movement on the recent passage of a basic income guarantee in Brazil. At changesurfer.com, you can hear the first half of the speech in which Senator Suplicy explained how the basic income guarantee was passed in Brazil. In the second half, he talked about the economics and ethics of the policy. To find out more about the campaign for a basic income guarantee in your country, visit the website of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Movement at witterquist.com/usbig/. Recently, there's been huge jubilation in the Bush camp behind the scenes of all the angst and teeth gnashing about the situation in Iraq, about the latest jobs report, the 300,000 new jobs that were added in March. If we average, it's pointed out by James Galbraith in Salon.com, if we average the 300,000 new payroll jobs every month from now on, how long would it take, Galbraith asks, to break the June 1999 threshold of job creation that occurred in the boom economy once again? And the answer that Galbraith calculates is 4 more years. In other words, it would take job creation of 300,000 jobs, new jobs, each month for the next 4 years. And then we would reach that point again in March of 2008. Now, Galbraith says, if you think this expansion is going to continue at this pace for 4 more years in the face of what will soon be rising interest rates, huge deficits, and the pressure to cut them, a deflating housing bubble, and most of all, the proven indifference of Team Bush to jobs policy, then frankly, you haven't been paying attention. So I'd look that up at Salon.com. But what Galbraith and many economists still cannot wrap their mind around is the roboticization and automation of the economy. And for that, you can definitely take a look at Marshall Brain's Robotic Nation blog, which he brings to attention last week, an op-ed piece by Bob Herbert called "We're More Productive, Who Gets the Money?" Bob Herbert says, American workers have been comfortably productive in recent years, but they are getting fewer and fewer of the benefits of this increased productivity. While the economy, as measured by the gross domestic product, has been strong for some time now, ordinary workers have gotten little more than the back of the hand from employers who have pocketed an unprecedented share of the cash from this burst of economic growth. What is happening is nothing short of historic. The American worker's share of increase in the national income since November of 2001, the end of the last recession, is the lowest on record. Employers took the money and ran. This is extraordinary, but very few people are talking about it, which tells you something about the hold that corporate interests have on the national conversation. Bob Herbert here is riffing off a report by Andrew Sum of the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University, a report that he wrote called the unprecedented rising tide of corporate profits and the simultaneous ebbing of labor compensation, gainers and losers from the national economic recovery in 2002 and 2003. This is the first time, the report says, that we've ever had a case where 2 years into a recovery, corporate profits got a larger share of the growth of national income than labor did. Normally, labor gets about 65% and corporate profits about 15 to 18%. This time, profits got 41%, and labor, meaning all forms of employee compensation, including wages, benefits, salaries, and the percentage of payroll taxes paid by employers, got 38%. In no other recovery from a post-World War II recession did corporate profits ever account for as much as 20% of the growth in national income. And at no time did corporate profits ever increase by a greater amount than labor compensation. Now again, this whole argument that automation in the economy and structural unemployment on the part of workers and the greater corporate profitability as a result of globalization and automation, this is a precise argument for why we would need a policy like basic income. The Robotic Nation blog can be found at roboticnation.blogspot.com. You can also see regular news about basic income, automation, and corporate profits at cyborgdemocracy.net. Cyborg Democracy is a collaborative blog for democratic transhumanists, nano-socialists, revolutionary singularitarians, non-anthropocentric personhood theorists, radical futurists, leftist extropians, bio-utopians, biopunks, socialist feminist cyborgs, transgenders, body modifiers, basic income advocates, world federalists, agents of the culture and the Cassini division, Viridians and Technogaians, all transmitting a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So check us out at cyborgdemocracy.net. Our nation is struggling to defend a traditional biblical understanding of marriage, so I'd like to offer this constitutional amendment to defend biblical marriage in the United States. Marriage in the United States shall consist of a union between one man and one or more women. Genesis 29:17-28. Marriage shall not impede a man's right to take concubines in addition to his wife or wives. Samuel 5:13, 1 Kings 11:3, and 2 Chronicles 11:21. A marriage shall be considered valid only if the wife is a virgin. If the wife is not a virgin, she shall be executed. Deuteronomy 22:13-21. Marriage of a believer and an unbeliever shall be forbidden. Genesis 24:3. Since marriage is for life, neither this Constitution nor the Constitution of any state, nor any state or federal law, shall be construed to permit divorce. Deuteronomy 22:19. If a married man dies without children, his brother shall marry the widow. If he refuses to marry his brother's widow or deliberately does not give her children, he shall pay a fine of one shoe and be otherwise punished, in a manner to be determined by law. Genesis 38:6-10. On the basis of these biblical principles, I'm sure we can reestablish the sanctity of the American family. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.